Good morning. Would someone answer their cell phone outside? Thank you. So, it's good to renew our practice periodically. So some people, I'm aware, think of their formal sitting practice, the sitting that they do every day or 5 days a week, as I personally advise. They think of this formal practice as a daily retreat from the stresses of life, of work and life. Well, I call this refuge practice, taking refuge from your life in your sitting. Well, treating your practice as a refuge from the stresses of work and life is wonderful. It's very good, very helpful. But if you only do refuge practice for years and years, you miss an opportunity for exploration and expansion that regular meditation practice affords. You miss part of what's happening to you as a result of having a regular meditation practice. And I'll explain what I mean. If you do have a regular meditation practice, you're cultivating tremendous psychic and emotional stability. And you can cash in on this. It's already in your body-mind, this stability. And it's there, and you can cash in on it by doing something adventurous. Simply something that you might not have thought that you could do before you started practicing. Like offering yourself emotionally in a way that you haven't before. Like becoming a big sister or a big brother, or being a hospice volunteer. Maybe you thought, well, I'm not stable enough, or always having too much emotional upheaval, so I could never do that. Take on a child, a teenager, and I could never take on someone who's dying. So if you think this about yourself, but you've had a regular practice for a long time, you might reinvestigate this. You might think about it again. Or even just acknowledging and recognizing that you've developed some capacity for absorbing pain and suffering so that your world could include a lot more possibilities. Like you could get married. You could commit yourself to a relationship. Or you could just consciously expand the territory in which you have an open heart. So if your territory is this small, being nice to your friends and open to them, maybe you could talk to strangers. Maybe you could hang out with a devastated friend. Be available to someone who calls you in the middle of the night with terrible crisis. And maybe they never thought of you before as the kind of person that they could call in the middle of the night, and you never thought of yourself as somebody who would be available in that way. But maybe you could, if you've had a regular meditation practice for a while, maybe you could start experimenting with this. Because if you're afraid, you wouldn't know how to act in this situation, in any of the situations I've named, you know, maybe you should try it out. Sitting develops incredible emotional and psychic stability. So if you've been doing it for a while, You may not realize you have reservoirs of stability that you might not have tested in a conscious way. You're capable of way more stuff now. And this is another reason it's good to look at your practice adventurously every once in a while. It helps you become aware of the fruits of practice, one of which is this tremendous stability. I actually think that's the basis for all the fruits of practice, this stability that makes you able to be open-hearted. So the way I'm going to talk about renewal of practice today is inspired in part by a New Year's ceremony that we did at Crystal Springs Sangha down in Burlingame. And every New Year's, part of the ceremony that we do is we take turns going up to the altar and publicly declaring our practice intention for the coming year. Well, this is tremendously helpful to practice, to make a specific commitment for a specific period of time. You don't want to make it indefinitely because, again, you lose track of it. But if you make a commitment for a specific period of time, a year or a practice period for 3 months or something, then you can stay on point. Then you can, and when you, in the low points, you can say, well, I can get through to the end. So if it's a period of time, that's the best. And then you can decide whether you want to do this indefinitely. So anything that focuses one's practice, there are lots of things that do this. Studying a koan, for instance, or studying a particular precept in all the ways that precepts can be studied, including literally. Doing a practice period, doing the summer intensive, or doing a personal practice period. I know someone right now who's doing a 2 month personal practice period. Zazen every day, you know, a 1 day sitting, and coming up to study with me for a day at my house in which we'll cook together, walk down to the post office together, study together. So this is a personal practice period. These are great, by the way. I know many people who have done them. Or you could do a routine activity mindfully, like the laundry or washing dishes. You could just say, well, for 3 months, I'm going to be mindful when I do the dishes. Or you could present your practice regularly to a teacher or to a friend. This is very inspiring and scary to present your idea of practice to another person because it forces you to come out of your fantasy life into presenting something to someone else. Or experimenting with how you handle stress. You know, you can say, I always do this, I will actually experiment for 3 months with doing this. Or you can break a bad habit very consciously. People, the individuals at the Crystal Springs Sangha, committed themselves to various things. One person committed herself to treating objects with respect. Just for the next year, she's going to be conscious when she touches objects. Another person doing a longer sitting once a month, a 1 day sitting or a 3 day sitting once a month. And another person just knows, noticing the rise and fall of a particular emotion, of this stressed out feeling. How does it come on, trying to catch it at the beginning? So that'll be a year's worth of very interesting practice, watching stress rise and fall. She may even get close enough to see what the thoughts are that kick it off. So this is, even though we do this at the beginning of the year, at Crystal Springs, it's very different from the conventional New Year's resolution type thing because of the difference between will and intention. So usually when people make New Year's resolutions, they say, I'm going to be nice to my relatives. And they will themselves to be nice to their relatives. Whenever their relative says the usual inflammatory thing, they grit their teeth and say, oh, is that so? Now, this is this is a fine practice, but after a while, the bad will accumulates and they find themselves shouting back at the relative, and it's over, you know, barely 6 weeks into the vow. So this is using will to carve a new behavior. And it leads to discouragement. You end up thinking, oh, I'm a bad person, or I don't have the capacity for this practice, or whatever. This is demoralizing on a grand scale. If you personally feel demoralized, you're actually adding to the demoralization of human beings in general by taking this approach. So there's a little softer approach, a little more diffuse and inclusive. And I think of it as more like intention. This is my personal distinction between will and intention. Is you intend to be nice to your relatives, say. So this is my intention. And what this is a little more investigative, a little more what would happen if I were nicer to my brother. What would happen? Would that affect his behavior? Better not be attached to that. Would this affect his behavior? Will it affect my behavior? What will it be? So you begin an investigation. You ask questions that take you deeper. Like, for instance, the first time you yell back at your relative, you can say, well, what's my bottom line here? How much abuse can I take before I have to do something? Before I just can't swallow it anymore. And why? What particular value do I have that is being transgressed here? So immediately it becomes an investigation. You're not discouraged. You say, oh, well, this is the reason. We got into that territory. If I try to avoid situations in which my relative can criticize the way I live, then maybe I have a shot at being nice for another month or so. So that's more, there's more information in that approach. And there's no discouragement because you're looking for information, not achievement. So this is curiosity, you know, and I do think personally that curiosity as a character trait is one of the most useful things that you can bring to practice. Because curiosity is not attached. Curiosity is just what will happen if I have public temper tantrums. If you're trying to deal with your anger, here's all the ways I can deal with my anger. I can suppress it. I can express it. I can try to learn skillful ways of talking. I can take an assertiveness training class. So here's all these possibilities. So you should run through them and see what happens. Body-mind-wise, what happens when you do these various things? Curiosity is a tremendous help in practice. Now, will. I don't want you to think I'm putting down will, so I just want to say a few words about that. You need will to start a meditation practice. You do have to get your rear end on a cushion. And for most of us, that takes will. So you make this vow that you're going to do this, and that, so when the decision points come up, oh, do I go out to, you know, right away play ball on a Saturday morning, or do I come to Zen Center to sit? I will myself to go to Zen Center. That's good. Or I have too much to do today, blah, blah, you know, all the things that can happen. So you just will yourself to do this for a certain period of time. Maybe 2 years or something. I think it takes about 2 years to just solidly get this in your body mind. But after that period of time, if will doesn't fade as your motivation for practice to be replaced by intention or some other thing, then it actually interferes with the perception of the fruits of practice. Gaining mind is too gross. It obliterates the subtle things that are encouraging in meditation practice. So, well, I think will naturally begins to fall away. But if you try to reinstitute it it's not so good. So try to detect some other kind of process that's happening within you after you're able to establish a regular practice for a while. So if you just sit to de-stress after a hard day or at the beginning of the day, and you don't integrate your sitting practice into your daily life, it's like you're carrying your practice around like a purse, just carrying it around. It's something outside of you. Like your practice is kind of like a growth or a tumor or something like that. It's kind of something on top of the real stuff. So this is a hard point to fully understand, really. We're so used to thinking dualistically. Like, here's my real life and here's my Zen life. I even hear people say, well, in the real world, blah, blah, blah. So when it's very hard to resist thinking like that. But when you use the phrase real world to talk about your self-interested world, ask why you're so dissatisfied you would actually come to a Zen center on a Saturday morning. You know, what's so real about the real world? You know, what are your real values? This is something to investigate when we're used to thinking dualistically. Or we're moral and upright and truthful with our friends, but we're a little shady with the IRS. That kind of thing. This just habitual dualism, not questioning, are dividing things into these categories. It's tremendously powerful and empowering when all your different lives and roles come together, merge into one life. You experience a tremendous rush of directed energy, a tremendous rush. You're always ready for everything because you're not spending all this energy deciding what category things go. Should I be honest in this situation? Should I? Blah, blah. You're not spending time doing that. So a monk asked Yanshan, can people nowadays realize enlightenment? And Yanshan said, well, it's not that there's no enlightenment, but how can we deal with falling into what is not essential? So the monk, when he said, can people nowadays realize enlightenment, he was talking about, we're so deluded. We're so collectively missing the point. Can anybody get enlightened nowadays? Many people say to me, can we practice like they did in the classical period? You know, we're so materialistic, this culture. We're so in despair. We're so helpless about our government. You know, is there enlightenment? And Yanshan said, it's not that there's no enlightenment. That's beside the point. But how do we deal with falling into what is not essential? So we call not falling into what is not essential a commitment to practice in every aspect of our life. So if you see everything as practice, all aspects of your life as practice, nothing is non-essential. Nothing. There's no petty part of your life. So it's not that we have to get rid of greed, hate, and delusion. We have to penetrate our greed, hate, and delusion with mindfulness. We don't have to leave the arena of greed, hate, and delusion. In fact, that's a pretty tall order. Just find some place that doesn't have greed, hate, and delusion in it. So we don't have to leave that arena, but watch greed, hate, and delusion. And we have to figure out how to not grasp things while simultaneously trying to attain them. To not grasp things while we're simultaneously attaining them. So this is our whole life, right? I mean, we go to the kitchen to eat. So we're always grasping things, always pulling things in. How do we not do this while we're going to the kitchen to eat? while we're going to our job to get paid, while we're cultivating clients for our livelihood. There's nothing that's not essential. So the commentary to this case in the Book of Serenity states, if accomplishment isn't exhausted, it becomes an extra appendage, useless flesh. It's extra, distracting. If accomplishment isn't exhausted, it's extra. You're not burning it up in the situation in which it arises. So quickly you should free your hands and relinquish both net and trap. Put it down. Put down the net and trap. So what should your hands be doing if they're not holding the net and trap, poised to catch your dinner? So what's essential? How can we stay close to the facts of our existence? The fact that we're born, the fact that we breathe our whole lives, and the fact that we die. Anything on top of that is extra. We're born, we breathe, we die. We cut through the nets and traps by focusing on our practice. And how? How do we do that? Well, I think that we can look to our suffering for a pretty good focus for our practice. If you can ask yourself, how do I suffer? What is the source of my suffering? And how can I watch how this operates in my life? I suggest to students all the time that they notice their suffering. We tend to gloss over our suffering. There's so much. We're assaulted constantly. Especially if you live in the city, you see other people suffering all the time. You turn on the radio or read the paper, there it is, all the time. So what we tend to do is gloss over, become numb. Just each new assault or outrage costs us, so we decide to turn it off. But it costs you even more if you turn it off, because then energy is tied up in keeping it away from you. So I actually advise students to notice all their little ka-chings, all the little stabs in the heart. When I'm driving and somebody suddenly turns off without making using their right-hand turn signal, I feel that little stab. Not only did they leave me, but they didn't even say goodbye. So I let myself register this. Register how inconsiderate other people are of me and how insignificant I, enclosed in a car, am to other people on the road. I have to face that reality. No matter what I think of myself, other people on the road, by and large, do not care. So this is a source of suffering for me, and I choose to notice that when I feel that little tightening of my heart. So it actually increases your energy level to notice these things, because you're right there with them. But if you gloss them over, oh, that's the way people are. If you're going to have a car, this is what's going to happen to you. Glossing it over that way reduces your energy level, because you have to tuck it away. You have to bring up your rationalization. You have to make room for yourself to live in a world that you don't like. Much more energy in just noticing your heartbreak and developing with your meditation practice the stability to stand it. The psychic and emotional stability to stand it when somebody turns off. So you can use suffering as a drill to penetrate into your deeply held beliefs and your neurotic strategies. You can get in there, look around, see what your options are. For instance, I'll give you a couple of examples of, at the beginning of the year, I was asking everyone who studies with me to sharpen up a little bit, focus, renew their practice. So one man said that he's been particularly bothered in this past year by when he has interactions with people, he considers himself very unskilled interaction-wise. Very skilled at his work, but not with people. And he says that he'll often leave an exchange feeling unresolved or unsatisfied in some way, even a brief exchange with someone. So it's like, you know, when you have an exchange with someone and it is satisfying, even a brief thing, like in the hall here at Zen Center, or people you'll meet at tea and cookies or whatever, and you have some exchange and you turn away, it's like the fire burned clean. There's nothing still in your mind about it. You're finished with this interaction and you turn to the next one or the next thing you're going to do. But this fellow was always having a sooty fire, a smoky fire. He starts going over, oh, I should have said this. Or when she said that, she was insulting me and I didn't even respond to that. And just all the time he's walking around with this unresolved interaction thing. So this, he decided that he would start noticing what is it that makes him dissatisfied? What just happened that didn't meet his needs? Is it that he didn't connect with the people? I think that's the source of a lot of our dissatisfaction. We just didn't connect animal to animal, human to human. Or he didn't move his own feelings through. You know, we often use other people to move things through, not even in a conscious way. You know, we just are with other people and just hearing their point of view about something else will just start to move things through for us. It's good to be aware when that's happening for you because, again, you come away with a clean feeling. And another thing is that sometimes he doesn't express his feelings. He's very passive. So already, it's only February, already he's telling me how much he's noticing that how passive he is. He does not, in interactions with people, meet people. He just lets them determine what the interaction's going to be. So this is very interesting to him. Now what's he going to do about it? He has various options. Then another person, she's the most interesting of all because she told me that what she wanted to do in the coming year was explore the anguish she has about her husband's relatives. She, you know, they are his relatives, but she doesn't like them at all. I mean, she doesn't like any of them. They have a whole different ethic than she does, different values. And so she, because of her children, she would like to resolve this in some way, to have a more positive thing. So what I suggested she do is to notice whenever they violated an opinion that she has, and then she can ask herself, is this opinion worth coming between me and the other person? So I thought this was brilliant on my part because she would be able to make the decision right there. You know, is my opinion worth, do I value my opinion more than I value this relationship? So I told her this. So in 2 weeks, she calls me up and I said, well, how did it go? You know? And she said, well, I didn't realize how right I really was. She said, I was almost on the verge of giving up my opinions, but I see now that I never should. These are terrible people. All right. So I just decided to use it to deal with my own inflation and go from there. So I didn't have anything to say to her. I mean, what do you say? So she calls me up again in about a month. So this is fairly recent that she calls me up, and she said, you wouldn't believe what I've just realized. I said, what? Prepared for anything. She said, I realized that I actually am in the process of projecting on to my relatives things I can't face in myself. Wow, she did the work. A completely different revelation to herself. So she decided to abandon the postpone her relationship with her relatives to deal with herself, to deal with her own grasping, her own materialism, all the things that she are in unopenness, her lack of openness to other people. She decided to deal with that before taking on the relatives. I mean, I can't tell you how happy I was to hear this. What a wonderful person, you know, to take this drill right in. She took this drill right in. And the last example I wanted to give you was someone who lives in this building here, actually, trying to live with other people. He says, you know, I can't control who moves into the building, clearly. And so I'm studying my responses to people, and what should I do about them, he said. I love the way he presented this to me, you know, very open. Of course, sometimes people present things to teachers in an open way when there's not really openness there, but anyway, I believe that there was in this case. So he was talking about this other student, that every time he saw this student in the hall, hatred came up, bad feeling about this particular person because of run-ins he had had with this person. And so he just decided to watch it. He was reporting to me a practice that he had already involved in doing. And what he reported to me was, sometimes when he saw this person, he would feel the onrush of bad feeling and the memory of how this person had violated him, you know, a couple of days ago. And then other times he would see the person and none of this would come up. He would just see the person as another person, and then he would go greet the person as if there were no bad feeling. And then the person would re-irritate him, and then he would have bad feeling again. And so this would go on. Next time he saw the person, avoid the person. But then after a week or so, he'd see the person and, oh, he'd be clear again and be friendly. So he said, well, where should I abide here? You know, where should I go? I said, it sounds great to me. You know, all the stuff that is happening, because this is how you track emotion. You see that that's like Zazen expanded over a long period of time. You see the feelings arise, you see them pass away, you see that they have very little to do with events, that it's almost like studying your own metabolism in a way. And so what does it mean to hold a grudge or to remember somebody who irritated you? This is very interesting. So this practice of just watching